Sometimes a child is born and the words male and female do not apply. These children have been categorized as intersex. There is often a rush to make some kind of gender classification on an intersex baby, and that decision will have an impact on the child for the rest of its life. Dr. Katrina Karkasis is a senior research scholar at the Center for Biomedical Ethics at Stanford University and author of the book Fixing Sex, Intersex Medical Authority and Lived Experience. It's published by Duke University Press. And Dr. Karkasis joins us now, along with two intersex women, Katie Barretz and Janet Green. Welcome to the show, all of you.
Thank you for having us.
Katrina, isn't intersex a catch-all term for a variety of different conditions?
Yeah, that's correct, actually. What's interesting is that the term encompasses a broad array of diagnoses, approximately 60, and they're actually quite different, which means that the biological features are different, the treatments can be varying, and because of that, the lived experience of those people with these conditions is also quite variable.
But are some conditions more common than others?
Definitely some conditions are more common. I would say probably the most prevalent is a condition that Janet actually has called congenital adrenal hyperplasia, and that accounts for about 60% of intersex conditions.
And what is that?
Congenital adrenal hyperplasia is actually... Well, Janet, do you want to explain it?
Yeah, Janet.
It starts in utero. There's kind of a flooding of androgens. And it happens to both boys and girls, but the androgen flood is a problem in the girls. It creates ambiguous genitalia in the girls, and so there's a real rush to early surgeries to normalize the genitals.
And you were born with genitals that were more typically male than female?
Yes.
So
at least outwardly. Inwardly, I have a womb and uterus, and so but outwardly.
And when did they find out that you had this condition?
Immediately. There's usually in the delivery room, there's a congratulations, you have a boy or a girl. With CAH babies, it's more congratulations, we're not sure.
Now, Katrina, what Janet described made it sound like this is really more of an environmental issue than a genetic one. Is that typical of intersex situations?
No, actually, I would say it's probably much more around genetic mutations and other things that cause different enzyme and other issues within the body that create these conditions. So I don't think that there's a great deal of proof that there are necessarily environmental causes leading to them.
Katie, didn't you appear to be typically female at birth? What made you different?
Yes, I...
And you look very female right now.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that. yes, when I was born, I looked totally like any other girl. And it wasn't until I was 6 years old that there was a tiny bulge in my lower tummy that my doctors and my parents, who happened to be physicians, just assumed was a hernia. But when they took me to the operating room, they discovered that it was a testis that had been higher in my belly that had been trying to descend like it does in boys right before they're born. And so at that point, they discovered that I had two internal testes. I didn't have a uterus or fallopian tubes or ovaries. Although I had a normal vagina, I had XY chromosomes instead of XX. And XY is male typical, and XX is female typical.
And what explanation has been given for this situation?
Well, it's very well described. It's something that's called androgen insensitivity syndrome. And what happens is that as a baby develops, the Y chromosome turns on this whole developmental process, a lot of which involves the reception of male hormones like testosterone, which are called androgens more broadly. And in my case, my body didn't respond to any of those androgens. So although I had testes that were making androgens, it was like trying to use a key on a door that didn't match the lock. So the door wouldn't actually open, and instead I got shunted down a different pathway to be female.
Katrina, what percentage of births are intersex?
You know, it's an interesting question because we don't have any national statistics in this country because we don't track these births. But a number that's bandied about quite a bit is 1 in 2,000, and that would be across all 60 or so of those diagnoses we spoke about earlier.
So that's not a lot, but it's still a lot. When you're talking about a population of 300 million people, that could be an awful lot of people.
Exactly, it can. And I think yet I imagine probably quite a few of your listeners haven't heard about this. And I think there are a couple of reasons. One is that it's been really hard to talk about, and there's been a fair degree of secrecy, not only from clinicians to parents, but parents to their own children about the condition itself and its treatment.
So intersex children continue to be thought of as abnormal, even though now we pretty much understand how this whole thing works?
I think any time that we're dealing with atypical sex characteristics, it's very hard for people to come to terms with that. And I think that's one of the things that the three of us are here trying to help, is really to normalize and say this is a variation, much like any number of other variations. It needn't be scary. And in fact, there's a great deal that doctors can do at the birth of a child with one of these conditions to reassure them and say your child is capable of having an absolutely marvelous life.
But are the majority of these children still being assigned to one gender or another?
You know, it varies so much by each diagnosis. The majority will be female assigned just because that's most of the conditions are more prevalent in young girls. But there's still some where gender assignment is very, very difficult because some people grow up to identify as male and some as female. They can have the exact same condition.
So it's also the mental aspect of it.
Completely.
A kid could grow up and think, well, I'm a male even though everybody's told me I'm a female.
And that happens.
Janet, how do people tend to react when they learn you're intersex? Or is this something that you kind of kept secret until obviously today at least?
It's not a secret. But I don't identify as intersex. I think intersex is a term to be used in our advocacy. I identify female. I always have. And it is not necessarily the gender assignment that is the only thing that's crucial. It is this surgical assignment that is something that has really been questioned, certainly in the past 20 years, whether it is right to surgically assign any body before the mind that's in that body acknowledges who they are and what they are.
And we've had situations like that where there have been surgery. There's the famous John Money case. Some years ago I talked to somebody who had written a book about that
John
situation. David Reimer, I think, was
exactly.
the kid. And they operated on him and made him into a female because they decided that was the better option, and he grew up thinking he was a male.
Right, but he was non-intersex. He had suffered a catastrophic circumcision. And the question the parents is, how do we raise him? Do we raise him with a boy without a penis? And John Money had felt through his studies that he couldn't live a healthy life as a man without a penis, that he should be gender reassigned. And it turned into a terrible, terrible life for David.
What about you, Katie? Is this something that you have always been open about?
Not that much. I wasn't really aware of all of the details of my diagnosis until a little less than 10 years ago, and I didn't really start talking about it publicly until I was in the very late years of college, I guess.
Now, why is that? Your parents are doctors, so they would probably be a lot more sophisticated about this sort of thing than the general public. Were they open and honest with you about it?
My parents certainly were very sophisticated in the way they thought about it, and they gave me pieces of information that were and used age-appropriate language. So when I've known from the time I was six that I wouldn't menstruate and that I wouldn't have babies that people have babies through adoptions, etc. But they didn't tell me about my karyotype, my XY chromosomes, that is, until I was about 17 years old. And part of that was because even though I've grown up in a very open environment, that's fairly recent, and the advice they'd gotten from their mentors and other physicians was, if you tell your daughter about her chromosomes, she's going to lose it, and that their interactions with the group of women in the androgen insensitivity syndrome support group really proved otherwise. So I've been very fortunate for that.
We have to take a little break. When we come back, we will continue this conversation with Katrina Karkazis, who is the author of Fixing Sex, Intersex Medical Authority and Lived Experience, and two women who are expert in the subject because of their personal experiences, Katie Baratz and Janet Green. Stay with us. We're back with Dr. Katrina Karkazis, a senior research scholar at the Center for Biomedical Ethics at Stanford University, author of the book Fixing Sex, Intersex Medical Authority and Lived Experience, which is published by Duke University Press, and also two people who can talk about much of what's in this book based on personal experience, Katie Baratz and Janet Green. Katrina, you write that at birth, genitals are viewed as symbolically and literally revealing the truth of gender. So how do social assumptions about genitals at birth impact intersex children for the rest of their lives?
Well, I think part of what happens is that when the genitals come out, and a word I've used is that they're not legible. And what I mean by that is someone can't read them as understanding them as male or female. I think that creates a lot of discordance in the thinking about understanding the child as male or female. And because of that, people have thought, well-meaning doctors and parents and others, that the best way to help this child would be to normalize the genitals for that child, that that would ease his or her transition later in life and spare them suffering.
Is that still happening? Are they still doing these operations?
Yes, yes. It's quite still very much considered part of the standard treatment paradigm. But what we've learned, actually, is that these surgeries, which These parents and doctors at times have understood to be unquestionably helpful, have been experienced by some individuals as profoundly harmful. And that's in part what explains an advocacy movement from people who have undergone this treatment that began in the early 1990s.
Do the parents and the doctors tend to agree on what's to be done?
Not always. And I think increasingly with the advocacy movement, we have some parents and some doctors who are suggesting that early genital surgery not be performed, in part because of some of the complications and in part sometimes so that the person themselves can decide.
Janet, what happened with you?
The surgeries that were done early at birth. And as an
infant, you had no say in the matter?
Oh, no. No, and I don't.
And if you had had a say?
Well, I mean, I was born in a time and place. I'm 51, and I think that decisions were made that were appropriate for then. But now, knowing what we know about gender and sexuality and development, that people need more of a right to have a say in who they are and how their bodies are. But the normalization surgeries are not always accurate. They're not always helpful. I think it's difficult in life to have a body that is nonconforming, and I think it makes people nervous. I think that there are better ways to do it, and one is to wait. There really is no urgency to these surgeries. I think parents take cues from not only society but their doctors. And I would say to any parent of a child that's born ambiguous to take a deep breath and to wait and to get information. And the surgeries have gotten much better. But by waiting, the surgeries will be even better and maybe even unnecessary.
Are the surgeries better because of what has happened with transsexuals? Do we understand those things better?
No, I think it's just in general how surgery improves, which is refinement in technique, better instrumentation, you know, new ideas or better understanding of anatomy.
Because this has nothing to do with transsexuality.
No, it doesn't. I think the easiest way to understand how it differentiates is that these individuals are born with medical conditions that present at birth, whereas transsexual adults choose a different gender identity later in life.
Katie, was there also surgery in your case?
Not genital surgery, because my genitals are female. But I did have surgery to have my testes removed. There was a slight chance that they'd become cancerous as I matured.
So you would have approved of that surgery?
Yes and no. I think it's there's really no clear answer in any of these.
There's so much ambivalence here.
Yeah, I suppose appropriately so. But in my case, I am glad that I don't have to worry about developing testicular cancer, which is a devastating disease for anyone. But I also feel like there was a part of myself and my identity that I didn't really get a chance to embrace and learn from.
Well, how does that work when you are in high school or college and those gender roles start becoming more and more important?
Right. And what's interesting is that so many of the rites of passage that adolescent women go through are almost entirely biological. The first menstruation.
Which you didn't have.
Which I didn't have. Development, which in my case was delayed. And so I sort of felt like I was always a couple steps behind my peers, which was very frustrating. But what was interesting is that it's sort of a mixed blessing in my case, because since I have no responsiveness to testosterone, I never had acne, I never had much body hair. So by the time my friends got over getting their periods, they wanted to be in my position. So it was
a mixed bag. But then at a certain point, you're dating, and whether you're dating a man or a woman, mm-hmm. you still have to talk about these
right.
things.
And I'm in a relationship now, and my partner is fully informed and very supportive, and it's something I feel obligated to share, because at a certain point, it's not just me that it impacts. It's also him. I always have worried that it would be a deal breaker, that a person would be like, whoa, this is just way too much to handle. But I don't think that's actually ever been the case. And maybe I've just been very lucky in that regard.
Have you been as lucky, Janet?
I think that in my youth I was brazen and didn't know enough about my own body. I think the things that I've learned and accepted in these past decades have made me more open. Whereas Katie, it's really divulgence of information. The divulgence of my information becomes evident at intimacy.
Do you know what your parents' reaction was when they discovered that you had this condition? I don't want to say intersex, because you said you're not intersex.
Yeah. When they found out I had CAH, I was just a few days old, but they knew, of course, that I was born without a clear sexual identity. To try and picture being back in the 50s, being young parents, getting this information. I think that they were pretty stunned. I think parents are stunned now that they don't know that a child is going to come out clearly male or female.
But to some degree, you were an experiment at the time for doctors and psychologists.
I was an early one. Yeah. And I think that because I grew up and married and had children, I was looked at as a huge success of a girl with CAH.
And do you think of yourself as a huge success?
I think that I had incredible determination and a very narrow acceptance of who I was and who I could be and what it was okay to be.
So as we have established here, genital surgery for intersex babies and related kinds of conditions have become very controversial. But do you think it's because people from your generation are now speaking out about what happened in 50s and 60s?
I think absolutely. I think that the advocacy movement, which at first was an activism movement, really brought forward to the doctors a question as to whether their protocol was the best way to treat us. One of the things that happens with these surgeries is they're done early. They don't usually tell the child. The doctor doesn't tell them. The parents don't tell them. And so it's very hidden. There is no evidence through all these generations that these surgeries have been helpful to us. We talk about evidence-based medicine now. There's really no evidence that these surgeries have helped us, been productive, and helped us move forward.
Katrina, would intersex individuals have once been called hermaphrodites?
That's definitely true. And it's an older term, and we even have a newer term now called disorders of sex development. But if I can,
keeps on getting more and more complicated.
Yeah, more complicated. If I can, I'd love to add something to what Janet just said, which is that I think the presumption has been in the clinical world that if you get the gender assignment correct and if you do genital surgery, that these children will have very good lives. And very surprisingly, only about 1% of outcome studies have looked at overall quality of life of these children. Most have assessed sexual orientation, the outcome of genital surgery, related things. And so this over-focus on gender, on identity, on genitals and sexual orientation has been to the neglect of broader health issues. For example, increased cancer risk in some cases, but also to these broader understandings of quality of life and what actually helps these individuals to have good quality of life, and we don't know that.
And you suggested, Janet, that you should have waited. You should have been allowed to wait before you had the surgery. Do you think you still would have had the surgery?
Again, it's time and place. I suggest now to all parents that they wait. There is no rush. Surgery in itself creates problems and issues, complications. There's very rarely early surgery without later surgery. I think that we are in a society now that's really about more acceptance in a variety of places. And we have to accept bodies as they're made.
Katie, have you met other people who have had similar situations?
Yes, actually, I'm a very active member of the androgen insensitivity syndrome support group. So I've met a lot of women with my diagnosis.
So I'm assuming there are also some places people can go.
Right. And there, I've actually become involved with some groups that are advocating for people with all kinds of intersex conditions or DSDs, one of which is the Accord Alliance, which is a very new organization, and people can find information at Accord, A-C-C-O-R-D, alliance.org. And it's remarkable, even if you're not someone who's experienced these kinds of things, to see that the same themes run through everyone's narrative and that they really apply to the life experiences of almost everyone. Everyone can understand secrecy and embarrassment and the liberation that comes with those being abated.
I'm sure there are some people who never, for whom it is still a secret.
That's very true. There are people that I spoke to in my interviews who had never told anyone before they told me and about their condition and their treatment. Some of these people were well into their 50s. Even more tragic is that they had never been intimate with anyone.
We will post all of the websites. You have a website you want to talk about, Janet?
No. It is the accordalliance.org.
Well, we will post that on our website so people can link to it. And my great thanks to you for being with us, Dr. Katrina Karkazis, whose book, Fixing Sex, Intersex Medical Authority and Lived Experience, is published by Duke University Press. Also, Katie Barrett and Janet Green. It's been a pleasure talking with you.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.